We begin our study in earnest tonight of the Song of Songs. Solomon's is the one that we have recorded. I am not sure. I've never seen anything about whether this is an actual factual event that happened or if it's one of Solomon's writings that he does this account and gives us these thoughts, but they certainly have a lot of teachings in here for us to learn from as far as a relationship with whether you're dating or married or contemplating or whatever. A lot of information here on that, and of course it's included in God's holy word, so it's certainly there for our study and our look at it. I know several of you have mentioned that you've read, you know, different versions and stuff, and you're confused. We're going to use my version, and I'll kind of interpret it how I've seen it, and we'll go from there. But hopefully, we can learn from this together and see some things that certainly are true and well for us to use and to have today. So we're going to be looking at chapters 1 and 2 today. That will be our subject, and basically this is an introduction of the characters, and so we'll get into that here in just a moment. I've asked Artie if he would to lead us in a prayer before we begin, so if you would, Artie, please.
Dear Heavenly Father, we're so thankful that you've helped us all to arrive here safely tonight. Pray that we all came here to learn, open minds, open hearts, ready to search from your truths, the things that will help us. Pray that we will use them to, if we are married, to help us to have stronger marriages. those who might be thinking about it, help them to look at what they need to be to have a strong marriage. And pray that you will help us to understand all these things and help us to apply them to our lives. We're thankful for this church and the light that it stands for in this community. We pray that we'll always be that way and that we can help to guide many souls to your fold. Pray that you'll be with Bruce as he instructs us tonight, and pray that you'll be with all of us and help us to just have pleasing you as our main goal. We're thankful for your son and all that he's done for us. We pray for those who may not be able to be here this evening, whether it be because of age or illness or because they're traveling. You know their needs, Lord. Please just bless them and look after them and help us to do what we can to help them. We ask all these things through your son. Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you all for being here, and those who are watching on live stream who are not with us in person, hope that you are able to glean information as we go through this and study. I'd like to begin, first of all, with a little background, especially concerning Solomon. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, the children of Israel are in Moab. They're not yet crossed Jordan to enter into Canaan. And God is giving Moses his instructions, and he gives him a little forewarning. He says, when this people gets into Canaan, they're going to ask for a king. He knew that was going to happen. That's one thing that they would want. He knows human nature, and they're going to ask for a king. And so he gives some qualifications for that. In 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 17, they're asking for a king. And so Samuel goes to God and says, these people want a king. What do I do? What do I say? He said, it's all right. He said, I know. He said, I will appoint for them a king, but here's the consequences of having a king. And then if you look at the account of Solomon and his wealth in the Kings and Chronicles accounts, why you see how much he had. The Jews living in Canaan, 10% of their property, of their flocks, of their belongings, would go to cover the religious aspect of their life, to cover the Levites, to provide sacrifices that were to be done. And so 10%, the tithe, is basically a tax to run the religious aspect. Well, when they get a king, and you can read in Kings and Chronicles about everything that Solomon had, somebody has to take care of all that too, and it's going to be the Jews. And so there's going to be more taxes levied. God told Samuel, he said, you tell them that the king will require their sons and daughters serving in the military, serving in the palace. You look at how much the provisions for one day's meals for the king and for all of the government that was involved was amazing. Well, somebody has to fix all that and prepare it and serve it and grow it. All that, somebody has to do all that. And it all belongs to Solomon. And think about someone who is the CEO of a company or the owner, the president of a company. It's multinational or spread throughout the country, and he's got divisions here and there and everywhere. And he goes periodically and checks on those different places just to see how things are going. Let his presence be known that, you know, I own this. You know, how are things going here? Making sure things are running smoothly. Well, Solomon does that. He's the king, and it's all his, basically. Doesn't own it all, but he's overseeing this. And so as we begin this account of the Song of Solomon, he has evidently been out inspecting his flocks and his fields and his vineyards. He's up evidently in the northern part of Canaan, and he's at one particular vineyard, and there's something in the vineyard that draws more of his attention than the vineyard, and that's a young girl. And he invites her back to the palace with him. And that's where we begin. So looking here in chapter 1 and verse 2, he brings her to the palace, but her mind is still on a young shepherd boy back home. Keep that in mind, that, you know, her thoughts and her heart are still there. He has brought her to wealth unimaginable. The Queen of Sheba was amazed, and she was the queen. She had seen wealth before. Imagine what this young girl sees, probably her first visit to the temple and to Solomon's palace, and she is probably overwhelmed with everything that is there to see. And she begins, and she's speaking about her shepherd, and says, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is sweeter than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the young women love you. Draw me after you and let's run together. For the king has brought me into his chambers." She probably didn't have any say in this. You know, he says, "You're going with me." And that happened. And she doesn't know what's going to happen there. But he brings her back to his chambers. And she's physically here, but she's... her mind and her heart is someplace else. And then his harem joins in, and they say, "We will rejoice in you and be joyful. We will praise your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you." We just finished our study of Esther, and in that we talked about Daniel and Joseph and Ruth. She has already gained the favor of all these other women in the harem, and she just got there. And what do you suppose it is about her that has drawn their attention or their favor? Similar, I believe, to Esther and Ruth and Daniel. What was it about her, you imagine? What attracted Daniel and Esther and Ruth and Joseph?
Their appearance.
Yeah, well, their appearance and what else? Even deeper than that. Because they were...
Their character.
Their character, yeah. You know, these people were slaves, were foreigners, were brought here, you know, Joseph had been in jail, you know. What was it about him that gained that favor and gained that attention? And it's their character. And I think we'll see the same thing here from this Shulamite, especially as we continue reading through this. And so then she begins here in verse 5, a self-description. And imagine, she's in this harem, and we mentioned before how many women Solomon has already married, and wives and queens and concubines and maidens. Imagine what their appearance looks like. I mean, they're done up to the nines. Remember in Esther, the candidates for queen spend a year getting ready. You know, these gals have probably everything needed to make them all look gorgeous. You know, their appearance is probably perfect, or they're probably not going to be in this situation. And so this Shulamite is brought into this, and she's a farm girl. You know, she describes herself here. She says, "I am dark and beautiful, you daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon." In 1 Samuel 16, when David is described, it said that he was ruddy, that he was handsome and ruddy. And the idea there is that he was tan. He was red, or he was darker, because he did what? What was David's job?
Shepherd.
Yeah, he worked outside. This girl works outside. She says, I am not like you. I'm not, you know, fairer skinned, you know, and you know, we're talking about those then in Israel who are going to be darker complected anyway, but she's going to be even more so because she's been outside working her lives outside. And she says, "Do not stare at me because I am dark, for the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard." I look at her here saying, I haven't had time to take care of me. I've been out in the fields working. I don't have time to doll myself up, because who would I do that for anyway? You know. So she says, I'm different than you. But she also has an air about here of self-confidence here when she talks about, you know, don't stare at me, you know, this is how I am, but I am beautiful. In her own light, you know, she understands who she is. And then speaking of the shepherd in verse 7, she says, "Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you have it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself besides the flock of your companions?" She's still thinking about him, and he's pasturing his flock somewhere. She wonders where he's got his flocks pastured. And she's, from the commentaries and the individuals that I've read concerning this last part when she says, "Why should I be like one who veils herself?" She's asking herself, I need to admit to him that I love him. She evidently hasn't done that yet, you know, just really opened her soul to him. She says, I need to tell you how I feel about you. And so the king now speaks. He's prepared a banquet for her. And he says, "If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go out to the trail of the flock and to pasture your young goats by the tents of the shepherd." She has a choice. He says, if you don't realize, you are beautiful. But if you're wanting to go, you can go. You know, he's not forcing her here. And he goes on, he says, "To me, my darling, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh." I know some of you ladies perhaps don't want to be compared to a horse, but I think this is truly a compliment, you know, that was one to be desired, that they looked at of all of the chariots and everything, you know, this one was the most beautiful. And he says, "Your cheeks are delightful with jewelry, your neck with strings of beads." And the harem says, "We will make jewelry of gold and beads of silver for you. We will fix you up. We will take care of you." And so she's sitting here at this banquet, but her mind again is elsewhere. And in verse 12, she says, "While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved," which is her shepherd, "my beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, a cluster of henna blossoms. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. How handsome you are, my beloved. And so delightful indeed. Our bed is luxuriant. The beams of our house and our cedars, our rafters, our junipers." She doesn't require a palace. And in chapter 2, she continues, and she knows her self-worth. She is assured of herself, and she says, "I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys." Now she switches and talks about her shepherd, her young shepherd back home, and she says, "Like the lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the young women. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Refresh me with raisin cakes, sustain me with apples, because I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. She's at this king's banquet, and there's probably food there that she has never even seen before, and in abundance. And she says, I would just as soon be home with the man I love and eating simple things and him embracing me, him holding me. And then she says something here that she will repeat several times at the end of verse 7. Or at verse 7, she says, swear to me, you daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or does of the field, that you will not disturb or awaken my love until she pleases. This harem is trying to convince her that you need to be here. Solomon wants you. You need to recognize how wonderful an opportunity that is, and you need to accept this and be a part of it. And she's telling them, don't force my love. Don't force me to make a decision here. My love will mature and develop as it needs to be, but don't push it. And then she says in verse 8, listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, leaping on the mountains, jumping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He's peering through the lattice. She can see him, that he has followed her there, though it's only in her mind, but he misses her, and he wants to be with her. And then she speaks for him as if he were really there in verse 10 and says, my beloved responded and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. Behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the blossoms have appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its fruit, and the vines and blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come along. It's time to go home. He's saying, all right, this season has passed, and she's imagining this, and you need to come home now. And then she speaks for herself in verse 14 through 17 and says, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding place of the mountain pathway, let me see how you look. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is pleasant and you look delightful. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bether. She admits here in verse 17 that he's a hard worker. He's with the flock. He's staying there until dark. She knows the type of man he is, and he has responsibilities, and he cares for those. And again, she is at the palace. She has been at a banquet. All of this stuff has been done for her, but she's thinking about him. So in these first two chapters, we've got this young Shulamite farm girl, young shepherd boy at home that she's known since childhood. They've grown up together. Their families know each other. And now all of a sudden, the king comes into the picture and his harem, his entourage. And so she's torn here about, here's the offer, but here's what I know. And where am I going to go with this? And next week, we're going to look at, Lord willing, chapters 3 through 6. Which is basically Solomon laying down his plea before her over and over and complimenting her and wanting her to make that. And so the next week is decisions. You know, she's given all this information. What's she going to do with this? I want to go through the questions now and look at these. But beforehand, anyone have any comments in particular that you want to throw out? You know, if it's really something I don't know, I'll just tell you I don't know, and we'll continue looking at this. But I hope that we'll look at this as Solomon recounts this story, and he's talking about a choice that this young girl is being put forward, and the choices that perhaps our children or grandchildren or young folks that we know that are not married and contemplating that, think about the consequences of your choice. You know, this looks amazing. This is what I've always done my whole life. You know, where do I want to go from here? And that's some hard choices. You know, our grandchildren, the two oldest ones now that have gone to Florida for school, I think have decided that they're never leaving Florida. They've had enough of the cold, and they're used to the heat, and they're okay. They're okay down there. You know, they have been introduced to a whole new situation, and they've embraced that. And I like this. You know, and so you know, not all choices are between good and bad. Some are between good and better. You know, God, we ask God for wisdom, so He gives us choices. So which choice are you going to make? And so, as we read this, understand that this young gal, and it's all on her, it's about her, and the opportunities that are before her, and what's she going to choose? So as we continue through this study, just, you know, kind of keep that as our, you know, the main thought. So any thoughts before I ask you all these other questions? And if you think of one, go ahead and raise your hand and ask. So I ask here, what are some characteristics or traits that attract individuals to one another? I just got a short list of 8 things, and I'm sure you're going to have a whole bunch more. But, you know, and you don't have to get personal, you know, about your own life if you don't want. But things that attract people to one another. Wayne?
Well, generally, the very first thing is physical.
Sure. If you don't think of physical or personal appearance, then you're blind because you can't see them anyway. You know, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, that's something that draws our attention. We have specific things, perhaps, about someone, whether it's stature, height, hair color, you know, whatever it may be, that attracts us. You know, and say, oh, that's interesting, and so that gets your attention. What else? Judy?
Personality.
Certainly. Personality. It doesn't take too long to think, no, this isn't going to work. You know, this just isn't my type. I even had one young fella tell me that he was, you know, seeing a young gal, and he said, I really liked her, but I couldn't stand her friends. You know, the people that she ran around with and her friends, it just wasn't me, you know, and to think that, you know, going into that situation and being uncomfortable around, you know, her friends all the time would just, again, be uncomfortable. And so that was something. So personalities, whether it's a person or their friends or whatever. Linda, did you have it? Oh, okay. Artie?
Common interest.
Yeah. Common interests. Things that you enjoy together, you know, that you can, as you develop perhaps later on in life together, that you can do things together if you've got one. And that doesn't always make or break one. My dad was a stay-at-home kind of guy. You know, he really didn't care much about going. My mom loved to travel, you know, so, you know, they kind of compromised on some things like that. But that certainly can certainly be something that draws your interest. Connie, did you have... Sure, yeah. Besides personality, just their character. You know, what kind of a person is this? You know, how is that going to affect me, Alan?
One of the things mentioned here in the text is a pleasant voice. So the tone of voice or just makes you think about even conversation, somebody you enjoy listening to and talking with.
Yeah. There's some individuals that had a voice that is unmistakable. You can be blindfolded and they walk in and you know who it is. And it may be good, it may be bad. You know, it just, you know, does that voice attract your attention, or does that voice, no, I just don't know if I can listen to that all day long, Wayne?
One thing that often, real often, plays a big part in it. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, and that's social standing.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. One thing I mentioned here that kind of goes along with that, or I wrote down, is financial stability or social standing. You know, where is this? If I become involved with this person, am I going to be going up or am I going to be going down? You know, in the community, you know, where is that going to be? And again, you know, she's a farm girl, been invited to the palace with the king. You know, this is, wow. You know, and we'll look at this a little bit later on, but certainly that standing and that financial security or stability is one thing that you would consider. Stan?
What kind of aspirations do they have?
Sure.
Are they really pursuing?
Sure, yeah. I mentioned that down as, you know, as goals, you know, what is it that they're wanting to do? If it's something that is going to take a lot of time, a lot of financial aspect or something, you know, is this something that I'm willing to be a part of, to be yoked together with? You know, again, not necessarily bad or wrong or anything, but just, you know, here's their goals. Can I be a part of that goal, or am I going to hinder that? Kenneth?
Whether they're selfish type person or not, constantly admiring themselves.
Yeah. What kind of opinion they have of this, of themselves, good or bad? Yeah. Absolutely. Phil.
Yeah. You mentioned stability, and mostly in the idea of financial. But I'm thinking that they're not all over the place. You won't necessarily know that first impression.
Sure.
But as you get to know somebody, you know, how's their life gone? I mean, they jump from one relationship to another. Do they, you know, do they go from one job to another? Is there stability in their life?
Yeah. Yeah.
Down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just financial stability, but emotional stability. And, you know, how's that going to work? Even, you know, some may look at someone and are attracted to him because of their intelligence, because of their schooling or their wisdom or, you know, the things that they are able to do. You know, they look at that and they say they admire that because they have that. Maybe they've worked very hard at that. You know, and earned a degree or whatever it is, and say, you know, they've worked hard for that. I appreciate that kind of hard work. Carrie?
My mom always told me that I should be looking for somebody who was going to help me grow spiritually.
Sure.
So somebody that would be spurring me on rather than holding me back, or holding our family back at some point. So maybe not something that you look for first of all, but something you're definitely looking for as you get to know the person.
Sure. And I've heard this several times at weddings or in, you know, speaking with young couples, you know, you find somebody that loves Jesus more than they love you, and make sure that they're going to help you get to heaven. And I've heard, you know, one, you know, a young couple, and one of them would say, I don't think they can help me get to heaven. You know, I don't think they're going to be that support for me to do that. And so they see that early enough to say, this is not where I want to go. And all these other things, you know, most everybody thinks about that, but certainly this idea of the spiritual aspect, and are they going to help me, is that going to be their goal, needs to be the number one priority for Christians, you know. And so when we're mentoring our, you know, young people here, or children or grandchildren, you know, that's certainly, they may not appreciate it as much now, but guarantee you, years down the road, that's going to be a big difference, because that physical appearance, well, you know how that goes. That stamina, that strength, all that stuff, that kind of changes. And another thing a lot of times is family. You're not just marrying this person, you're marrying a family. How is that, what is that family relationship like, and how is that going to be a part of that and stuff? And so those certainly are some characteristics. So what does Solomon have to offer? Unimaginable wealth. And we talked about, you know, position, security. Those things are a lock, you know. never have to worry about that. And then he can offer that. And that's certainly one of the things that is offered there. What's a shepherd have to offer?
Hard work.
Go ahead. Yeah, hard work.
Hard work, but he also truly cares for her.
Yeah, yeah. His faithful love to her alone. Solomon's already got a clan, you know. I mean, he's got wives innumerable almost, you know. And that's just going to continue. And yet, this shepherd, and she calls him, and this is the passage that's up on the board, you know, my beloved is mine, and I am his. And she knows that. And so she's looking at what is offered out here, but she also knows here, this is what I have. You know, and so that's going to certainly play a part in making her decision. Alan?
The beautiful outdoors emphasized in like verses 12 and 13 about chapter 2 about, you know, the fig tree ripened its fruit, the vines and blossoms and fragrance, and let's just take a hike.
Yeah.
Let's go for a walk.
Yeah.
And so it's not the beauty of a palace and all that, but it's the beauty of God's creation enjoyed out in the country.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly we read in Ecclesiastes that Solomon had gardens. He had things to go look at, you know, but it's not the same. And so, you know, he has this to offer. What is it about, and this is throughout the account of this letter, the next, you know, seven chapters or so. What is it that attracts these two men? What attracts the king to this young girl? It doesn't point it out as much here in the first two chapters, but it certainly does in the rest. What's he looking at?
Beauty.
Yeah, yeah. She's a beauty. And you think of, I mean, the wives that he has already are queens. They were princesses, you know. It's not that they're not beautiful. But she's different than all these other ones. She's not the same. And a lot of times that will attract a person because, you know, you know, maybe this is any way to pick someone that is out of your comfort zone. That's not, you're not used to, you know, because it's different. And so he looks at her, and perhaps she's a challenge that he'd like to conquer, you know. I can't remember some of the older movies, you know, where, you know, they would take some young gal who was an orphan or whatever out here and make her, you know, whatever, you know. She's a challenge because of who she is. And we're going to see as we read on, as we already have seen, that she's a bit headstrong. She's not arrogant. She's not boastful of herself, but she knows who she is. And you know, he looks at this as here's a woman who is herself, and maybe he's not been used to that. You know, maybe he's sees, you know, this is different. I like this difference. Phil?
I can't even imagine 1,000 women, you know, already, you know, one more.
Yeah.
You know? But at the same time, a lot of those were formed with alliances.
Sure.
With Pharaoh and Egypt, and to try to keep peace. And this might be one that's actually, you know, for a different purposes. It wasn't to form an alliance. It wasn't to get on the good side of Egypt or anything like this. It would be something different, you know. And,
yeah.
So part of that could be that attraction.
Yeah, yeah. Phil's right here. A lot of his other marriages were business deals. You know, they were arranged. You know, and you know, the bride may or may not have had a choice in it. This gal's got a choice, and he's hoping she'll choose him. You know, and he's really gonna put that out here. So what's a shepherd look at? What does he see in her?
Someone that's acquainted with what he, you know, what he's acquainted with.
Okay.
That is, she works the fields. He knows that she knows what to do.
Yeah, yeah. He knows she knows how to work. She's not going to be one that's sitting at home like these other in the harem, probably primping and whatever, you know, to look beautiful for the king. there's other things to do. She mentions, and I think this one point, I think that's the point she's trying to make, is that I don't have time to take care of my own vineyard. She doesn't have time to doll herself up, because there's other things that need to be done, that have to be done. So he sees in her that similarity, that, you know, he already knows that about her, because he's known her since, you know, they were children, you know. So he knows her family. He knows her background. He knows what she's capable of doing. What's some other things, Alan?
Well, he's got eyes, too. He can see her beauty.
Yeah.
That's pointed.
Yeah, yeah. And she, I mean, she goes through quite a bit of a, you know, description here of him. You know, she's pretty well struck on him. She said, you know, all the young maidens love you. You know, the women love you, you know, because he's a good-looking guy, you know. But they have that physical attraction there also. It's not that he doesn't see that. What else does he see in her? Artie?
Familiarity.
Sure. Yeah. Just with the king, she doesn't know anything at all about him except what she's heard and what she sees out here, you know. But here, they both know each other. You know, this is comfortable, you know. Stan?
He wants to be with her wherever they are.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't read this in the first chapter so much, but we're going to see it as we continue along. He sees her virtue. She's saving herself for marriage, and he sees that. And she admits that later, that, you know, that's what she's done. She said, "I am saving myself." And look at who she's competing with. You know, 300 other women. You know that. You know. You know, and I'm saving myself for this one. And he sees that. He sees that inner strength and that inner beauty in her. And that's something to be desired. Just a few minutes left. In verse 2, in chapter 2 and verse 15, she says, "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes." And the study I've done on this, it very well could be describing the things that divide a couple, that can cause division. And these little foxes are ruining the garden. And she will later talk about her garden as being her virginity, her virtue. And she says, you know, "I've kept my garden." And she says, you know, the foxes, these little foxes, are causing problems here. What are some things that can cause division in a relationship? Not that you've ever experienced that, you know, you hearsay.
Being unfaithful.
Sure. That's certainly a tiebreaker, you know. The loss of fidelity and faith and trust in someone who's not faithful. Phil?
And to a lesser degree, maybe divided attention, period. You know, obviously he's got several women he's going to have to pay attention to.
Sure.
And she won't be the only one in the life.
Yeah.
Just in general, divided attention.
And it's not always another woman. I was listening to a song the other day. I like to listen to music. It's a Garth Brooks song. And this gal was upset because her husband was going out of town. It wasn't because of another woman. It was because of the rodeo, you know. Sometimes outside goals and interests that our spouse doesn't share takes up all that time. And so there's more attention spent there than here. And so even though it's nothing that's wrong, it's divided attention and not being able to share that. The things that you mentioned that we look at that attract one another, you know, like financial stability. Finances can destroy a relationship, you know, if you don't have the same goals and how you want that to work. The intimacy of marriage, you know, again, as Christians, you're entering that relationship and it's pure and now you're with someone else, and how's all that going to work? You know, sometimes that will cause friction between a couple, and how do you deal with that? And so, you know, that's one of those things of having a foundation spiritually that Carrie talked about helps us deal with whatever it may be. In-laws ever cause a problem in a relationship, or friends, you know, there are as many things that can cause division that can cause attraction. And I think here this young gal is saying there's things here that are starting to cause some division. Help me with this, you know. Anita?
I was just thinking of different family values or expectations. The story is told about the girl who wakes up and her father always made breakfast. So she's laying there waiting for the husband to get up and make breakfast.
Yeah.
Well, in his house, mother always made breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's laying there waiting for her to get up and make breakfast. Yeah. So they're a little confused.
Yeah, yeah. And those things, you know, those things happen. And so as we continue studying this, you know, we're gonna see, you know, these decisions that she has to make, and the things that are coming at her from every other direction. So kind of keep that in mind. And next week we'll continue and look at the king's pressure to get her to look to his side. Thank you.